Hello and welcome to the Advanced Age Role Playing Gamers Podcast. I'm Nathan. I'm your host this time, and we've got a return guest. We always like a repeat guest, Gareth Hanrahan, novelist and designer of many of the games you've seen on shelves all over the place, from Free League to Delta Green and Gareth, say hi, and why don't you give us a quick spiel?
Yeah, I'm Gareth Hanrahan / Gareth Ryder Hanrahan, depending on how big the spine is. And yeah, I write role-playing books and novels. The novels are there, some of them. Actually, so it's one of the role-playing books, because that's Dracula from the Dracula dossier.
Yeah.
Which is Pelgrane Press. And yeah, I've done lots of work for Pelgrane, King 7, Mongoose back in the day, Free League, doing ordering stuff, and I'll write this moment, but... For the purposes of this podcast, I'm doing stuff for Roland Rook and Deckard.
So, Roland Rook and Deckard, we played Eat the Reich about a year ago for no particular reason.
And have you recovered?
It was cathartic to play that last February. So, you know, a lot of things were changing in the world, and it was nice. It's a little prophetic, but anyway, moving right along. So I've also listened to an actual play of the Die RPG, and I don't know how much our audience knows about the Die RPG, so I was wondering if you could give us an overview of what that's all about.
I'll actually do my best. Kieran has a better spiel, but I will attempt to emulate it.
I believe in you.
In my own idiom, thank you. Okay, the Die RPG is based on the Die comic, so we're going to do the comic first. The comic's premise is basically, the usual spiel is Goth Jumanji. It's about this bunch of gamers who are dragged into a D&D-influenced fantasy world. In the comic, it happens 20 years ago, they escape and they're dragged back in. And they go through all sorts of traumatic adventures there. The role-playing game is based on the same premise, where basically you are a bunch of gamers who, for various mystical reasons, are pulled into the realm of Die, which is this fantasy realm that is influenced and shaped by role-playing games and history of fantasy. And there you arrive and you are transformed into these paragon heroes. So basically in the role-playing game, you're both playing, you've got your regular personas, your person from our real world, or your Nebushi gamer, and then that person's dragged to Die and they're transformed into this hero, but you're still playing their character, who's playing a character, if you follow me.
Okay, so do you have two character sheets?
The persona doesn't really have stats, because it is just it's your personality, but
okay. You
have basically your sort of heroic identity of your paragon, both that they are being played by a person who has been dragged into this game.
That's pretty cool. There's I've heard of a friend of ours. They have an actual play that does an isekai theme, which I guess is the same sort of deal. And then there's dungeon crawler Carl, which is not quite the same thing.
Similar vibes.
Similar vibes. So it's regular people getting drawn into a fish out of water situation.
Exactly.
So that's pretty cool. I listened to an actual play of it. I'll link that in the description. It seemed pretty fun. But this, I saw this announcement and I was like, oh, this is for us. it's the Die RPG Meta Dungeon. Meta Dungeon. So from the little press release, it looks like you're running through just all the decades of all the role-playing games. You're kind of in each of these dungeon levels is based on an era of role-playing games. So was I close? Did I get it close?
That is pretty much the premise. I mean, the Die comic goes through the history of how gaming formed. Basically, they've encountered sort of the ghost of Tolkien at one point. They go through the Brontes, they go through Kriegspiel. It basically, over the course of the story, they trace how gaming evolved, because the comic gaming was basically a vessel for the creation of this entity, Dai. And basically, for the meta dungeon, we're going to zoom in on one section of that. And in the realm of Dai, in the land 13, there is this meta dungeon, which is basically this dungeon inspired / shaped / recapitulating the history of gaming. So there'll be sort of six levels. Each level is basically one decade of gaming. So you enter the dungeon, you're in this level inspired by the 1970s. It's all 10x10 corridors and old school maps and numbered encounters. And the encounters in there will basically be, I don't want to say like a tutorial or guide or history book, because it's elements of that, but it won't be a serious history, but they'll be inspired by like the Gygax-Arneson feud or the development of TSR or the first gen cons and so forth. Basically, we'll be going through the history of gaming and translating that into gaming encounters.
So folks that are familiar with Thaco and the 10-foot pole, they should recognize where they are when they get that first level.
They should indeed. And also they will like hopefully be inspired, or like you'll be inspired / confused by some of the references, like, you know, there, for example, there was the whole bit where TSR bought a knitting company. And we will...
Oh.
Yeah.
I didn't even know that. I learned something today.
Indeed. That was in Slaying the Dragon. Which is, it's very Play of the World as well. Basically, there are all these weird events in the history of gaming that I want to sort of like basically turn to gaming encounters.
So I'm assuming you're somebody who likes puns a lot. And
it is a special obligation in the sky.
So you're going... So the meta part, you're really just leaning in like 1,000% on that.
Absolutely. I mean, it's going to be an interesting project, because on like one level it's going to be a serious underlying. It's not going to be a comedic parody or anything. Mm-hmm. This thing will still try and kill your player characters. It will still be as traumatic as Ty can design to be. But it's going to be filtered through the history of gaming.
So how do you go about, because you've got a lot of ground to cover, so how do you go about deciding what goes in on each level?
That's kind of what we're doing at the moment. We're going through the history books and the Stan Appleton's Designers and Dragons tomes, which basically trace the history of the various companies. Mm-hmm. And picking out basically either the things we have to cover, what do people remember from the 80s? What were the key games for that era? What are the big things of the 90s? And also then just picking out the interesting or weird unexpected bits that can be turned into encounters. So it's basically trying to be as comprehensive as possible while keeping one sort of eye open on what can actually be like turned to playable material. I just worked out there how to do the various nonsense bits with printers. Because if you read history of gaming companies, an awful lot of it is then being in debt to printers or printers fixing things up. So I wanted to get that in was how you do that in a game. And I think my basic solution is to have this random encounter table where every so often this giant stinking war machine, like dripping ink and something out of Terry Gilliam or something, was coming rampaging through the dungeon.
Okay, yeah.
Attacks you, steals all your money, and marches off again.
So this is going to be a treat for folks that have been in the industry for a while, also who will probably recognize.
I mean, yes, if you're steeped in the industry and the history of the hobby, there will be lots of Easter eggs and so forth. I'm hoping as well that people who haven't, what's the word, squandered their lives, that's it.
Right.
who are just coming to gaming, started gaming with 5e or even started getting to the comic, will also find interesting bits and go, oh, hang on. What's this based on? What are they talking about here? And then we will have a wealth of footnotes and references saying, this is what we are parodying. Or
Yeah, I could see, like, you know, even with what my wife and I are just watching TV, if we don't understand something, okay, well, Google that. What are they talking about there? So I can see that happening, like, during games. Like, okay, what's the deal with printers? So as part of this, are you looking at some of the aspects of other early TTRPG companies like the Palladiums of the world and Hero System and kind of touching on some of those aspects too? Or
yeah, I mean, the spine is going to be D&D, but that's mainly because like the gaming industry was right. and is D&D to a large degree.
Yeah.
And certainly the 1970s level is mostly going to focus on D&D. But my plan is you have the dungeon in the 70s, from the dungeon you go to the wilderness, you step out of like level one onto level two of the 80s, and it's going to be a hex crawl or something, because in the 80s gaming sort of explodes into like, you know, different systems.
Yeah.
We've got Cthulhu, we've got Traveller, Paranoia, Hero, Lady and so forth. And we basically have encounters referencing all those things.
That's neat.
And then you get to the 90s, you've got the cultural dominance to a degree of White Wolf, but you also have magic cropping up and, like, you know, swamping the gaming industry.
Okay, yeah.
And also you've got, like, you know, the start of the indie RPG movement that really sort of burgeons in the early 2000s. Because 2000s then is very much the 3.0 and 2.5 and the resurgence of D&D, and also the foreign stuff. And I want to do a whole adventure sequence about the OGL.
that could be a little spicy.
But at the same time, it is like, you know, one of the defining historical bits of the gaming.
Yeah.
I mean, without the OGL, you don't get Paizo, which is like, you know, a huge thing. You don't get the explosion of companies in the early 2000s, the whole D20 shelfware boom and bust.
Oh, the indie folks too that are just, you know, freewheeling on drive-through RPG and itch.io.
I remember when Ron Edwards was selling Sorcerer as a PDF, he emailed me, it was like one of the first indie games you could buy electronically, because, like, you know, one of the huge changes was just the move to playing stuff through PDFs and electronic formats as opposed to having printed books. And also the fact you could do smaller print runs meant that people weren't, like, you know, mortgaging their house to print 20,000 copies of a book and then selling five of them. I mean, the whole year of the whole, like, you know, bringing disastrous fantasy heartbreakers.
Right.
And then you get on to the 2010s, and that's basically probably the apocalypse and also the rise of streaming and podcasts and YouTube and the whole
Kickstarter, probably.
Kickstarter, crowdfunding.
I was just wondering how
crowdfunding is going to fit into this. It's an excellent question.
There's got to be a way to, it's got to be some kind of enormous trap where it looks like you're doing really well, but you've really lost everything.
It's like this pit filled with gold coins. You're trying to climb out of it, but you're getting more and more gold coins. But they're slipping away from you at the same time.
Right. Yeah. 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 That's exactly how I view Kickstarter. Like, I back a lot of stuff, but the people I've talked to is like, it's I was successful, but I didn't actually make any money.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. They're like, ways you can fail Kickstarter are not funding and funding.
Right.
But that's sort of part of the challenge of the book, and also the interesting part of basically taking all these events, going, okay, how can we take this and use it as a metaphor for a thing that actually happens in a game?
Yeah.
And the other part of it is, in Die, you have your persona, and you build up your character's relationships and backward in the real world. You go, like, okay, you know, why did my character stop gaming, for example, is including a big part of this thing, because basically we're going to have the characters from different generations of gaming. So basically, your character would have, like, you know, played in the 80s and then given up. And, like, you know, how do you feel about gaming? Why did you stop? And then the personality of your character will feed into the encounters. So one thing that Dial the Roleplay Game really encourages is basically connecting the characters to the fantasy, to the fantasy stuff they encounter. So in the comic, for example, one of the first people they meet is this elf queen, and she looks just like this girl they all fancied in high school who they never actually talked to. The lich at the end of the dungeon speaks in the same, in the voice of your boss. And like, you know, addresses all his zombie minions in the same commanding tone of voice. Like, you know, says, kill those adventurers. They're all the highest priority. Each one of them. So another part of the book will basically be going, here is the weird history-inspired encounter. Here's how to twist that weird history-inspired encounter so it targets the emotional weaknesses of one of your players.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of us, as far as our podcast go, Matt and I started playing in the 80s together. Actually, about half the group, four or five of us, started playing in the 80s together. There definitely it's real that it's, since we left college, there's kind of a wasteland of no gaming for a while because everybody had moved or went to a different college or got married or joined the military, and thankfully we all found each other again. But there's definitely some rough times where this is something you really miss about doing with this group of people.
Gaming is. It's a hobby that really gets into your head and, like, shapes... I mean, I don't want to say it shapes your personality, but it does mean, like, you know, I don't know any gamers who really treat it that casually. Even if it's just, like, someone who plays D&D, like, you know, once a month or something, it's still there in the back of their heads. To play a role playing, you have to put so much of yourself into it that it's going to be more of a sort of an intimate personal experience than playing a board game or watching a TV program or something. So you are, because it's creative, you're putting something yourself out there, and that requires a level of emotional investment that makes it
break trust. And and once you find kind of that magic group that you jive with and you can really actually be yourself, you don't want to give that up.
And then you, like, you, one of the parts of this game is going to be, okay, the reason your characters get embedded into your dragon is because there is this one guy called the Gamekeeper, who is basically this gamer who has lost his way. And he is going to basically force you to learn the history of gaming. He's the antagonist on the whole dungeon, basically.
Okay. Yeah.
He pulls you in and is going, right, you will like you. You appreciate gaming as I appreciate gaming. I like you.
Okay, that's me. All right. Yeah, you
know, I will make you love this properly. I'll make you like you. Really, really no gaming.
That's great. So what's the... when did you start working on this?
Well, the games have been floating around for a while. And then they announced that Goodman Games organized this Mega Dungeon Month on BackerKit.
Yep.
And we should do something for that. And thought, we have this idea lying around. So I haven't actually started writing it yet. We've just been doing lots and lots of planning.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we've been planning it since Christmas. But on another level, I've been researching it for many, many years. Because I've always just been... I mean, part of it is we've been working in the industry for 20 years. But even before that, I was the sort of nerd who was reading Dragon magazine and paying attention to, like, you know, the names of the designers and going, where is that company based? Oh, what have they done? And it's been great the last couple of years because gaming had the number of sort of academic studies of gaming and, like, you know, books on the history of the hobby have exploded. So you've got, like, you know, John Peterson.
Actual resources, yeah.
Yeah, Ben Riggs and stuff, Sean Applefine, all the... Hall, I thought that the... With a giant monster's alien that holds the ground.
Right.
Haven't yet cracked it open. How long?
You need time.
But there be the moment has come due for this project, I think.
I think so too. The Die RPG itself looked pretty intriguing already, but kind of couching it in this meta dungeon theme, I think that really might make me actually pull the plug and you know, pull up my wallet and get it going. But Yeah, I did listen to a whole actual play of it, that, and it was pretty intriguing that way.
It is a lovely game, and also just very, very involving, because you get into the whole. I don't know any other role playing that sort of so foreground the emotional experience of play and what your characters want, and, like, you know, to encourage the players to be the architects of their own misery, basically.
Yeah, and there's something to being able to take your friends through kindly take them through these different decades of gaming, and I think for older gamers like us, it might cause a lot of nostalgia. It's like I need to break out that old hero system book and get out the spreadsheets and start working on that character. Do you have like a schedule, like when do you think this is something that you'll be able to wrap up and get to in the hands of people?
It should be either end of the year or sometime early-ish next year, but don't hold me to that, because no. I know when it's crowdfunding. After that, it will end up. I mean, hopefully, it should all go fairly smoothly. Everyone involved in this has done this a lot, so
yeah.
But I don't know the exact release date yet.
I wouldn't, this is still early days on this, so I wouldn't expect a release date. But end of the year, early next year, as long as the planet's still here, I think we'll...
Exactly. early next year, brackets, like, you know, tariffs, wars.
Oh, right, yeah. Now, I don't even want to ask this now, but I was thinking, like, it's still, like, way early, but do you think if this is successful, do you think folks would want to see the meta dungeon, maybe a system agnostic type version? Or
not sure if you're doing system agnostic. It's going to be so meta and so tied to die that I do think that it will be an interesting read even if you're not playing die. I don't think you could play it without, because it will need the whole two-level effect where basically the persona and the paragon. I mean, that said, one thing I've learned is that the gaming team will find some useful things.
Now, are you going to have some of the aspects of the effect only the paragon versus or only the real person?
Well, one thing about mega dungeons with a G is that, like, a regular dungeon, you tend to have basically one entrance, one way in, you go through to tier, go out again. Mm-hmm. One of the defining qualities of the mega dungeon is that there are multiple entrances and exits. You basically can, like, you plan your way in, you can find other ways in and out. So for this, also because a regular die campaign, or regular die game, tends to be fairly short. Like the rituals of the core scenario in the rulebook is basically a two-shot. Basically, one session, make your characters. Second session, you can have open campaigns. For this, though, because for various spoiler reasons we won't get here, I want to break it up a bit. So there will be sections where you escape the meta dungeon back into a version of the real world.
Okay.
You'll be playing the paragons or the personas.
Personas,
a bit. But that would be, like, fairly freeform and systemless, and then you get dragged back into that dungeon for another level or two.
Okay. But not like a real Jumanji, or will it be kind of like a real Jumanji where the fantasy world kind of creeps into their real world?
A bit. I won't get too much to it now because I'm not sure. But yes. Basically, you will not be back in the quote-unquote real world, but you would be exactly in die either for a little bit.
Okay. Well, it sounds like you've got, like, a lot of interesting little twists and turns planned for this. Now, When you're running, what kind of DM are you? Are you like a open end or railroady or somewhere in between? Or do you like to torture your friends for everyone's mutual pleasure? Where would you put yourself in there?
Because a lot of the time I'm like doing games for work, and I try and I'll be trying to consciously align myself with the goals of the system. And basically, like, you know, so if it's a hardcore dungeon crawling, like, you know, survival-esque game, I'll try and be like, you know, okay, dice fall where they may, like, you know, I will not be merciful. if I'm running something more casual, then I'll sort of emulate that. Left to my own devices, know that I'm really, really good at running individual sessions, and I have terrible trouble remembering what I've done between, like, half. Oh, the next session, like, you know, I will construct this incredibly intricate plot for one shot, and if we go to the second session, I'm going, oh, hang on, I know that that squirrel meant something. I should have written all this down.
That's not too different from me. I have a couple of friends who take amazing notes.
Basically, as soon as my players leave, getting on my phone and sending these very, very long WhatsApp summaries, while it's all some fresh in my head.
Yeah, no, that's good.
The other thing is, I suspect I'm a fairly soft GM, because when I'm writing modules for publication, I tend to basically make them fairly harsh to sort of counter that. The other thing is, I move around a lot. I'm a very bouncy GM, which is kind of intimidating, because I'm like, you know, 6'3", so
I remember we could see eye to eye, which is nice. So
I mean, you're a huge believer in busy moving around the table, and, like, you know, not there's fantastic diagrams that was in, like, Cornell, something, is doing on his blog, where basically it's like showing, like, you know, different table dynamics, where, like, you know, you've got, like, you know, GM and all the players just talk to the GM, but the GM and the players talking amongst themselves, or, like, you know, GM talking to some players over the side, but it's showing, like, you know, the sort of conversational flows. And there's a huge virtue in breaking that up and basically going, okay, instead of the GM always being this throw at the end of the table, I'm going to run around here and talk to, like, these two players individually, or, like, you know, put that player over there on the spot. And basically just disrupting the sort of set structure of the table. I'm weirdly obsessed with tables for gaming, and just, like, you know, the physical space and how it affects.
It is different, especially for the past, it'll be 5 years in April that we've been running this podcast. But all of us have played together at tables for decades. I've seen some conversations online recently about this too. It's definitely a different dynamic playing in person at a table, and to our detriment, I think our normal flow with my main friends, the GM will talk to somebody, but the players are talking amongst themselves in character, and which is not great for a podcast, which causes me a lot of editing. But
that's really great for the table, though. But, like, that's one thing I wanted to talk about in Red Dungeon, is the shift towards actual play and gaming as a performance. And just the idea of, like, you know, because for the vast majority of gaming's history, as in, it's been this incredible intimate thing, like, you know, it's what happens at your table that matters. No one else is ever going to see that game. Whereas now, suddenly, we have this explosion of other people being able to see the game, other people being able to, like, you know, to talk about it, and the game becoming, like, something for the audience. Like, the idea that, like, you know, what's a critical role we'll be playing to, like, you know, stadiums full of people.
It's wild. It's really wild.
It is absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, it's we don't have a huge following. I think we're 1,400 subscribers now on YouTube, and probably another third of that for just for the audio podcast. And it's rewarding. We're not doing it. We're not getting any money or anything like that. That's not the goal. It's just neat to actually have people that actually come back, you know, week after week.
But it fascinates me, if you went back like 20 years, that would be the equivalent of like, you know, 6 people sitting around a table and then like, you know, 1,300, 1,400 people sitting in the corner, even stripping on them. Yeah. If you take your audience and imagine them in the same room,
I tell you, there's. It makes me wish we started doing this sooner. Not really. I mean, partially to get the audience. When people comment and stuff like that, there's definitely a nice endorphin hit on that. But I wish we had recorded sessions for years, because there's stuff that we talk about. And there's stuff that I've forgotten, and somebody will bring it up during one of our games, like, oh, I've forgotten all about that. and it's so great to be able to kind of keep going back to that. And at least now we have like this permanent record as our minds slowly deteriorate. We go back and watch and listen. So there is a weird new dynamic, and I'm not sure what it's going to look like, you know, 5-10 years from now, but it's pretty enjoyable to be kind of a tiny sliver of it.
Well, one thing that this whole research message proposed, how young gaming is as a hobby. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it's 60 years is not a lot of a long time compared to, say, like, you know, the development of the novel or the stage play or something.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's also fascinating to see how wild the early stuff was. Like, you go back to Playing of the World, the history of the very early gaming. And there's such wonderful experimentation there that, like, you know, sort of prefigures loads of like things that are like, you know, really cutting edge indie games these days. But yeah, and also the way technology has impacted, like, something about printing, about streaming, about podcasting, about crowdfunding. So now you've got like stuff like AI and things. So I don't know where it's going to go, but it's going to be an interesting trip.
Yeah, I hope we can do it as long as we can. You know, eventually maybe this will be a solo podcast. But it's great, and we at its core, I think the draw to it is the storytelling, which people have been doing since, you know, since they could, you know, make fires. But
it's the creative storytelling. It's not just like, you know, we're going to retell the same story. It's like, I'm going to tell a story, and you're going to say, oh, hang on, I'm really interested in, like, you know, that goblin over there. And then that goblin becomes this fundamental part of the story. It's the whole collaborative building thing improv with history. It's just... There's nothing like gaming. I get very, very excited and emotional talking about it.
Part of the core is storytelling, but it's, you know, the improvisation and the feedback that you get from other people at the table is makes things pretty alive. You know, we have our goblin is a donkey called Miserable Beast that shows up in all of our stories now. But it's funny that a lot of people have that kind of like that keystone NPC that they try to inject across multiple stories, and so there's a lot of shared experiences where of people that have never talked or never met each other that take on the same type of bits of the story.
Yeah, and so in jokes can, like, you know, now because through like podcasts, it's become this, like, you know, this widespread meme. I'm sure Miserable Beast has shown up in other people's games already.
People talked about that, and there's one of our first games we played for the podcast was Twilight 2000, we had a couple of pretty famous, infamous NPCs from that people really latched onto, we're still like, this is again 5 years ago, and they're still talk about it when I go into the 2000 like Reddit groups and stuff like that. So, So it's pretty cool that that somehow we've influenced people that we've never met and don't really have any other kind of connection to. So it's neat. It's bizarre and very, very privileged to be able to do that. So what else have you got going on these days outside of the meta dungeon?
Oh, lots. My next novel is out in August. The cover is actually going live on Wednesday.
Oh, okay.
It is The Dungeon Book, which is basically Rudyard Kipling's Jungle Book, only instead of the poor orphan child adopted by wolves and a jaguar and a bear, she's adopted by a tribe of goblins and a minotaur in this D&D-esque dungeon.
Okay.
That's out in August. I'm working on the Terraforming Mars role-playing game at the moment.
Oh, okay. I didn't know they were making a role-playing game out of that.
We're doing a role-playing game. And it's really, really, really interesting because basically it's a game about building stuff and managing projects and shaping the future of Mars. So it's like, it's not like any other game I've played before as a role-playing game, because we were trying to basically take fairly dry topics and turn them into dramas. And we have a solution, or what seems to be working. I ran a game there which was about engineering Martian-tolerant shrimp, and it turned into a compelling drama, so I'm happy with that.
Well, I played a game a few years ago called Shadows Over Seoul, which had a lot of building.
I do remember that. Was that a Traveller Drive or that?
Not sure. But anyway. Check it out. It's got some nice kind of home base building mechanics kind of built in that was kind of separate but part of the role playing. So, it might be something to.
I should take a look.
Yeah, you should. It's pretty good.
Well, building. Trade of the second edition is coming out fairly soon.
Okay.
The Paragon Blade, which is this one player, one GM fantasy thing from Palgrin, is also coming out.
Okay. So, actually, I'll stop you there. So I've seen a lot more games where they're either solo or one player, one GM. That's not really my thing, but can you talk a little bit about that while I have you here?
Of course. Pelgrane have this line of what are called Gumshoe 1-to-1, and they've just also done a drama system 1-to-1, which is page turners. Basically, the idea is, I said, one player, one GM. The big differences there are, obviously, you can't kill the player character in the little scenario, so basically all the systems have mechanics where basically the character can get into trouble and have problems and so forth, but it won't knock them out of the scenario until the end. Mm-hmm. The other thing we found is that you need to give GM a lot more support, because when you've got like six people at a table and said they will all be talking amongst themselves, the GM can sort of sit back and like, you know, relax.
Yeah.
Whereas if it's just one GM, then you're always on. There's no downtime for you. There's no time to sort of sit back and think, other than the absolutely vital bathroom break every so often.
Right.
But the huge virtue of it is that you can do stories that are much more focused or much more emotional or much more involving, because you only have to deal with one person and you can focus on their reactions, their plots, their story, which is a much more natural way of storytelling in a lot of ways than trying to handle a group of six people. It's easy enough to handle Sherlock Holmes and Watson. But if you've got Sherlock Holmes, Watson, and six other people, it becomes harder. Or similar, Lord of the Rings, we've got Frodo and Sam traveling and so forth.
Right, yeah, okay.
If you don't jump an entire party, you can do, it opens up a lot of story spaces.
I can imagine it, because a lot of the movies you watch, usually there's just one main character or if there's maybe a buddy dynamic or something like that. But Blade Runner, that was I love the Blade Runner game, but it's definitely harder to have a bunch of cops, you know, because the movie that everybody knows is, you know, one person or one person plus one.
Exactly. I remember once playing a Western game and we all rolled up taciturn, like mysterious men in the corner to the party gathered in this bar, and we're all sitting there. It's like, you know, in the corner, it's like, you know, hats pulled down, smoking, like, you know, because everyone had the same concept, which was didn't work very well.
Whereas, yeah, I'm a loner, I don't work with anybody,
which works fine in a 1-player 1-GM thing,
yeah.
But the huge sort of draw of 1-player 1-GM, which we found, is it's basically people running games for their significant others. Like, yeah, you know, the boyfriend or girlfriend who isn't a gamer but is vaguely curious about it. And that was especially huge during lockdown when basically everyone was stuck inside.
Okay.
That makes sense. That point. Yeah.
I have gotten my spouse to role play now, but I'm not sure if I could do a one-on-one game with her, because I think she might stab me, but yeah, that's really neat. Thanks for taking time to because I've been curious. I wasn't sure what the draw was, but that explains it pretty well. I appreciate that. I appreciate you giving us some of your precious time. Is there anything you'd like to wrap up with before I let you go?
I think we've covered pretty much everything. Meta Dungeon is crowdfunding in April as part of Mega Dungeon Month.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go and follow the backer kit, you can download the die quick start to get a taste of the game.
Beautiful.
Okay. And a better explanation than I've given.
I'll put those links in the description. Yeah. Beautiful. All right, so I'll be looking forward to that in April. But again, Gareth, it's a pleasure seeing you again. I hope I'll see you again on one side of the pond or the other eventually.
We're small, like, you know.
All right, so thank you, Gareth, again for spending your time. I look forward to seeing the crowdfunding for the Meta Dungeon and your new book in August. So that sounds fun. Thanks, everybody, for watching, and we will see you again next time.